Here's something crazy too. So United will sell me Jetstar before they sell me. They'll sell me a connection on Jetstar before they'll sell me a connection on Ava.
Yeah.
Which is.
They sell on fucking Dragonair before they sell in Singapore.
It's crazy to me because, like, Jetstar only operates coach flights. You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with host Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller. So, Seth, you're back from the Paris Air Show.
Yes, I am. And as is typical, not the most direct routing.
Well, I saw you were going through Dublin. Is that how you got back here? In the
I
city?
got home via Dublin. That was work. I had a couple of days there for Future Travel Experience Conference. So we actually had some interesting conversations about connectivity and ancillary revenue and baggage processing. I've written a bunch of that stuff for Runway Girl Network and some videos and stuff. So that'll be trickling out over the next few days and weeks. But that was work. Before that, I actually ended up in Antwerp for a few days between Paris and Belgium,
Oh.
or between Paris and Dublin, and was supposed to go to Ghent. I like Ghent. I've been to Ghent a few times. I think it's a cute little city. Pretty churches, yummy food, good beer. What more could a guy want? And I was going with my wife, celebrated our anniversary over there last week. So, in typical me fashion, held off on booking a room while I was trying to sort out different options and things and whatever. So I booked my train tickets. So we had a train ticket, and it's actually interesting. The Thalys, the high-speed train service of Belgium, the high-speed rail mostly just goes to Brussels, but they have an option of a sort of any Belgium station ticket. So if you try to book Thalys from Paris to Ghent, you get a reserved seat on the real train, the high-speed train, and then there's like an add-on that's like any other station in Belgium. So it's just valid on all national rail services for a couple bucks more. I think it's a couple bucks more. I didn't really compare pricing, but we were going somewhere, so that's what I did. So I had those tickets and then ended up not going to Ghent and was able to still use them because Antwerp is also a station in Belgium. So that was interesting, I thought. Just like, it became a semi-flexible ticket in some ways, but.
And what was your reasoning for not being able to go to Ghent? Like, what was the
Ghent, it was like completely sold out. We couldn't get a, there was, it seemed like there was an athlete. We ended up actually going as a day trip from Antwerp once we figured it all out. And there was, like, hotels were booked solid, and there aren't that many hotels in town. There's a Marriott right in the city center. And it's like, if you're walking down the street, you would never know it's a major hotel. It's like the facade is typical of the style of the buildings and whatever. It blends in perfectly. It's really nice. But it was also going for something like €500 a night. Yep. And it actually at one point had award space available, and that was at like 35,000 points a night, which isn't awful, I guess, at the hotel world level. I'm not a huge hotel loyalty guy, and I think we had the points, but it was more expensive than I wanted to spend for a night. And so I started looking at other options. I went to a bunch of Airbnb listings, and like I thought it was fine because there were 10 or 12 people that had rooms available. And one by one, as I searched, I sent them emails saying, hi, I'd like to book. They all said, oh, nope, not available. And then it would suddenly disappear, like
Interesting.
over and over and over again. So that's pet peeve about Airbnb, people who don't keep their calendars up to date and then screw you. But ultimately, but there was like an athletic competition, there was a cultural something, there was a beer festival, it seemed. There was just a whole bunch of shit going on. So we didn't stay there. And as at a last minute, sort of started looking around, like, where else in Belgium can I go? And based on the fact that there's a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Antwerp, it's a 16th century printing museum. It was absolutely incredible. But literally based solely on the fact that that existed or that exists, and I could sell my wife on, hey, we got a different option now. Look, also they had hotel rooms available. Completely called an audible and booked it, a couple days in advance, but got and changed our trip. And so we ended up in Antwerp. And I tell you what, I fell in love with the place.
I liked Antwerp. I'd sent you a recommendation for a
Yes,
restaurant.
we had burgers at the place.
Was it
You
okay?
suggested. Yeah, they were good. They were really good. I mean, it's right on the like main square area towards the water there.
Yeah.
Good selection of beers. Guys didn't, judge us too harshly for being stupid Americans.
And it is a little hipster. It was a little hipsterish, in my opinion. I don't know. Just
We
me.
never actually went into the restaurant. We sat outside.
Okay.
So I can't vote on that. And we were relatively early for lunch. So I think we were the only people there when we sat down. It was like right at noon.
Yeah.
But we didn't do a ton of going out at night bits. We actually had one fantastic Michelin-starred restaurant meal. It was our, anniversary celebration dinner that another friend recommended. And it was it was interesting. The chef comes out and he's been Michelin starred for like 20 years or something like that, maybe 30. He's been doing this a long time. And he comes out, and it's actually very funny. We walk in, and someone said something to us in, you know, Flemish or Dutch, and we're like, excuse me? Like, oh, English, okay. And then, like, one by one, you've sort of heard the wait staff passing the message along. No, that table's English. And, like as he walked over, he said something to one of the other tables, and the maitre d' who sat us thought he was talking to us, like, no, English. It was very amusing. They were obviously very accommodating and much better speaking English than we are at most languages. But the chef comes out and just rattles off a list of stuff. Like, for appetizers, we have this. What do you want? It was fine. We picked stuff, but it's, I don't know. I wouldn't mind, like, I don't mind the guy explaining what he's doing, but having a list of them, it was just I felt like a lot of pressure and a little challenging to remember what the options were. And I don't want to be like, could you go through that list all over again? Because I wasn't paying enough attention.
So they had no English menu. So we have to give you the menu verbally.
They do it for everybody. There's no menu.
Oh.
One of the quirks of the restaurant. And it's what's nice is it's whatever's fresh.
Yeah.
Right. I had something that was like bacon, like pork belly, smoked pork belly and eel.
Interesting.
It was so good. That was the appetizer. And the mains, I have to go back and even now look at the pictures because there are also a couple bottles of wine and some champagne. And it's like, hey, you sit down there, it's like, would you like the house cocktail? It's champagne. We're like, well, then yes, of course. And that was after I think we had a beer or two before for, you know, because we're in the country and you want to experience the culture. Beyond the good meal and whatever, it just, I don't know, I thought the town itself was sufficiently small and easy to walk around. It was really pretty. I don't know how much of it's restored versus wasn't completely destroyed in World War II, and I'm sure you know that better than I do. But, and, you know, just that, and then this museum, the printing museum, was really, really incredible. The family that ran it was sort of genius businessmen and managed to maintain it for hundreds of years. So it existed into, you know, I think the 1960s. And so that was, you know, current enough that people are like, oh, wait, we can, you know, we can't be printing anymore, but we can make money running a museum and we have all the stuff still. So like back in the day when you were creating a printing press, you created a punch, essentially a positive that was your font.
Yeah.
And so you had these metal stamps, essentially, that were the font. And then you use those to create a negative that was cast in metal. And then you use those to create a different metal one that was the actual letters that you used in the press. And so you could always recreate more because you kept that original cut stamp that you didn't really work with. And this guy, one of the reasons he was so successful is he bought the original stamps from all of the designers. So if, you know, it takes time to make them and obviously to make a full set of different sizes of a font and consistent and this and that, it's a true artisan skill.
Mm-hmm.
And they're expensive, obviously, because of that. But by basically hiring the best artists to do it and then buying the actual originals, no one else could use those stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it so that other people were very delayed in getting more, had to use a substandard vendor. And he did foreign languages in a way that, you know, let him basically be somewhat of a modern Rosetta Stone. They printed a 5-language Bible in the late 1500s, early 1600s, I think.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, because everybody was speaking in Latin, but they also had Hebrew and like Assyrian and a couple other languages. It was just really neat stuff. And he had all the stamps to do it. But one of the things that was on display was the original Garamond. And Garamond, the font, is based on a guy named Garamond with a T, and he cut the art for this guy, and he cut these, you know, he cut these letters, and so they have, you know, 500-year-old version of Garamond sitting there.
That's pretty fascinating.
Or 450 years old, whatever it was. Yeah, it was really cool.
It's interesting. So I was just doing a little bit of quick reading. You had said that they had some Hebrew, right?
Yeah.
In there as well. I didn't realize it, but Antwerp has a very sizable Jewish population. Did before World War II, and then it became the seat of Orthodox Judaism in Europe, kind of, after the war.
Not surprisingly, it also has a very large diamond merchant operation.
Because with the port and that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's all tied together. There's a couple new museums that we didn't get up to, just too short a trip. But there's essentially, I think it's like the Red Star Line Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's it was the departure point for a lot of people fleeing Hitler in World War II. And even prior to that, people fleeing Europe, Jews especially. So there's sort of like it's being called the counterpoint to Ellis Island. many ways.
Yeah,
like as a museum.
Yeah,
so
the one on
there's
outside.
The embarkation point, so the disembarkation point.
Yeah.
So it's really neat. We didn't get up there. I would love to. There's some cool architecture and a fancy art museum. And the food was even, not the fancy place, but we had Indonesian food, which is more typically sort of super famous in Amsterdam and in the Netherlands. But one place managed to run in town there and was delicious. We just really good food. Everything we ate, vaguely reasonably priced for being a tourist in a touristy town. Small enough that you could really get a feel for it in 2 or 3 days and like be comfortable with it. And the roving gangs of 18-year-old girls who seemed to be running the city were reasonably friendly. Which I mean, none of them were hostile towards me. Seriously, they were like, every time we'd be walking down the street, there'd be these, not large, but groups of 6 to 8 girls. And we never saw a similar sized or group of guys. It was just weird.
Interesting.
So. Huh. Yeah, so there's that.
So Paris Air Show, let's talk about that. A380
yes.
Plus. Tell me, you saw the mock-up of it, I guess? Those weren't real winglets, were they?
No, they're not, and that pissed everybody off. So basically Airbus is desperately trying to keep the A380 line alive. We've talked about this, I feel like, far more than it deserves, but Airbus keeps trying, so we keep talking. And the latest version is they're trying to get – they want to put winglets on it instead of new engines. And so they're talking about a 5-meter-tall winglet, 4.8, something like that. It goes up 3 meters and down 1.5 off the end of the wing. It'll still fit within, whatever the parking spaces that are allocated for the A380 size, which are some of the biggest on airports anyways. And they expect that will deliver 4% fuel burn improvement. They want to make it heavier, so higher max takeoff weight. And that basically comes in the form of more fuel capacity so that they can carry additional passengers or get better range. And they're talking about all the other stuff that we've talked about in the past. So the new stairwells that are not sexy but take up way less space, putting 11 abreast in coach potentially, taking premium economy from 8 across to 9 across, getting rid of the storage on the top deck, just all those little things combining crew rest. Like right now, flight attendants and pilots have separate rest bunks, and they want to combine them all into one and put it downstairs because they realize that no one's actually carrying cargo on these things because they can't really do it very efficiently. Just all these little things that they're trying to do. And so the goal is something like 13% lower cost per seat mile.
Wow.
When all said and done. So that's great. It's not great as a consumer if the airline saves 13% because you get less space, and they've made the claim that passengers won't notice that it's 11 abreast and, things like that, because you'll have the same width room and this and that. I'm skeptical, having not seen the product, and last time they tried to show off a product that they said wasn't going to be that big a deal, it was. But we'll see. Someone has to actually decide to develop it and buy it before we have to worry too much about it. And when all said and done, the only customer they have right now really is Emirates.
Yeah.
And does
Emirates find this useful?
Right. So that's the real question. Emirates was the one that was always pushing for the Neo, a new engine option. And this isn't a Neo, it's a Plus. So we're not going to, we'll call it what it is. So it's not a new engine, so you can't call it Neo. But Emirates, at one point, someone got an interview with them, and basically the comment from Sir Tim Clark, from their CEO, was, okay, but we're not willing to be the only customer for the aircraft type.
Mm.
This is good progress. We're happy to see that things, can be more efficient and better, yada, yada, yada. You got to find some other customers, or we can't buy more. We can't be the only person, the only airline supporting airline. And that's prudent. You wouldn't want to be the only customer of a product.
Yeah.
And it's not even just because you think the vendor can screw you on pricing and, hold you over the bail because they own you. It's also from spare parts perspective, from, maintaining stores at outstations, all these things. If you're Emirates, you can potentially borrow A380 spare parts from Korean or Asiana if you're stuck in Seoul. You don't have to you don't have to stock that yourself.
Yeah.
Things like that. So, then again, remember what happened with Delta and was it Emirates or Qatar? They put in the spare part and then had to pull it out.
Yep.
It was Emirates.
Yep.
Wasn't it? Back in Seattle.
Yep.
So things like that. So Emirates, was in the "we like it, but" phase of the process. And I am skeptical that this solves the A380's problem of no one wants it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where that was, you know, arguably Airbus's big news of the show.
I mean, is there potential for someone like, say, ANA to maybe support this? I mean, they just bought some used ones, right, recently?
No, they didn't get used ones. They're taking the three that were originally earmarked for Skymark.
Mm.
So I think it's probably 18 months ago now, Skymark went bankrupt. ANA won the bidding war to pull them out of bankruptcy. And one of the clauses, Airbus was a major lien holder against Skymark because of the, you know, payments due for the planes. And so for Airbus to approve it, ANA agreed to take delivery of the three.
Gotcha.
And so they're going to paint one like a giant sea turtle. It's going to be cool.
Yeah, we talked about that on one of the shows.
Yeah, we talked about that a couple weeks back, a couple months probably now. So we talked about delivery and stuff. So they are going to take it, and they're going to run them to Honolulu and back, apparently.
But is there potential for them to say, okay, we'll take a Neo just with, or a Plus
a
in
plus.
This case?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of the challenge is when is the engine, right? This is a demo of what it would look like, but they didn't do any of the engineering work yet.
Mm.
So Airbus hasn't committed to actually delivering these winglets until people agree that they want to buy them based on the sort of promise of this 4% improvement. And so it's a little bit of chicken and egg of, you know, is anyone going to buy them before you guarantee that, you know, before you can demonstrate it works, or we have to take it on spec. And to be fair, I think we've seen overall winglets work, certainly for long-haul service. But, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges Airbus has found with this is that it the sort of idea of these massively capacity-controlled airports sort of is just happening slower than they predicted.
Yeah.
I actually should point out, I don't know if you probably didn't see it. Maybe you did. There's an interview John Walton, one of our frequent guests, did with Malaysia Airlines CEO, I think also during the show, where he said, he talked about the 380 and how great it is. You know, it's like, forget showers on board and fancy bars and things like that. Pack 800 people in and just use it, move them back and forth. It's great for charter ops.
Hmm.
And right, he's looking at it from the view of running Hajj flights and things like that to Saudi Arabia. But, and I arguably it could work with migrant workers also, but I just don't see, again, enough markets, enough places where that's going to work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking like the Hawaii routes. That's why I kind of brought up ANA, is because the Hawaii routes seems like somewhere where they could utilize that functionality, right? The Hawaii is a huge Japanese tourist destination.
Yeah,
it's quickly becoming a Chinese tourist destination. It seems like they would be, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No. And again, like, and so three planes sort of covers their Hawaii needs.
Yeah.
They don't need 30. And. Right, domestic operations in Japan have severe competition from a spectacularly efficient train service, and Tokyo is no longer really a major connection hub.
Yeah.
It's kind of out of the way.
Yep.
So, you know, part of that depends on what happens between the U.S. and China. And, you know, does that become a more liberal market? Do they open up open skies or something like that? But we don't know. And until that happens, but right now, I mean, Tokyo is, Narita is certainly sort of shrinking in importance. And that was one of the, that was frequently one of the A380 destinations because it was route limited. It was slot limited.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it'll be fun to watch. That's for sure.
Yeah. Going alphabetically, next up, of course, would be Boeing. they launched the MAX 10, which is the next stretch, super long, sort of 230-ish passenger, which will really be, I think in a two-class config, they're selling it. They're targeting 180, 190 passengers, 190 seats or so, on a single aisle with a single boarding door. So, hooray, turn times. And that's sort of their A320neo, or excuse me, 321neo fight. And this is, Boeing didn't have a product that competed with the 321neo, and now it does.
But this isn't the 757 replacement.
No, it actually has less range than the MAX 9. Mm. And they're not going to design a new wing for it, is my understanding. I think it's just the landing gear and a couple other things. Maybe there's some wing tweaks, but yeah, don't quote me on that now that I've said it twice. But I think, you know, the interesting thing there is it's, you know, United ordered 100 of them. That's a big order.
Yeah, definitely.
But overall, the overall numbers was interesting. A lot of the orders are conversions from other MAX aircraft.
Mm.
you know, some airlines and leasing companies like, oh, you got a bigger one. That's better. We'll take that instead. And so a little bit of this is, you know, sort of have to see how it all shakes out in the long term, but it's, we'll see. I don't know.
This is more about capacity than anything.
Yeah. And so arguably, right, it's trying to get super low chasm, but on a narrow body. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, in some ways, right, is it the same argument as the 380? Yes and no. We're seeing upgauging in a lot of markets, both in Southeast Asia and China and in the United States, North America regions, but to, you know, 200 seats, not to 800 seats.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, and obviously, like, operating costs are way different. Even though the 800 seat plane is cheaper per passenger, if you fill it, filling 800 seats at a particular time is hard.
Yeah, so I mean, could this be a PS plane, I guess? Could they configure this as a PS flight? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Transcom. Boeing advertised it showing the Vantage seat, which is what JetBlue, I think it's the Vantage seat. It looks a lot like it. The staggered sort of 2-1, 2-1, 2-1 mm-hmm. was the original Swiss business seat. Was, I think, the Vantage XL, which is the bigger version, but it's what JetBlue has on Mint, things like that. So there is, and we've heard rumors of new direct aisle access, narrow body business class offerings coming soon. So yes is the short answer, right? And the range is perfect for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you have a dedicated fleet of those, and, you know, the operating costs, because it's targeted at that market, right? The operating costs would be way lower than the 757s even on those runs.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the theory.
So did you have a good time?
I did, but there's so many more.
Oh, what else you got?
Hypothetically.
What else?
Bombardier, I think, sold one C-Series. It was really sad. Wow. I was really hoping to get some, share some orders. I really love that plane. I'd love to see more of it flying. But that's that. And then Boom.
Ooh, is this the supersonic carrier, right?
Yes. Yeah. The guy's based out in Colorado. They had a big press conference to announce, you know, updates, and a whole bunch of people in there. It's good, you know, good size crowd. I was hoping for a mini model. We got posters instead. So, you know, win some, lose some. but it was interesting. The CEO and founder got up and, you know, they got a demo plane that they're going to build, which is small, but they want to do sort of proof of concept, show that the engines work and all these things, and, you know, the carbon fiber frame and the wing shape and all this stuff is going to work right. And so he says that with the $40 million in funding they've received, you know, it's that they've gotten from outsiders plus internal funding, that's enough money to build this plane, this demo model, and get it flying, which is impressive. I mean, it's a small experimental type, but the stuff that they're doing is super cutting edge, so that's great. And they also said they have orders from airlines for 76 from five different airlines.
Wow.
The demo is supposed to fly in late 2018, and they think, I want to say 2020 or 2023 for commercial service, one of the two. Even I think it's probably 2023, just if I had to, but I'd have to go back and check my story. But either way, that's the part where I'm skeptical.
You don't think it could happen that fast?
I think doing it that fast would be incredibly challenging. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're getting real money for these orders, right? He made a point of saying it's not just letters of intent on all these 76. Some of them are real orders.
Yeah.
So there's real money being put down to get delivery. And we know that, I think Virgin Atlantic has been public about saying that they're interested in the product and they were an early supporter. And Richard Branson loves that sort of thing. And the New York to London market makes sense for supersonic in many ways. But there was just there's a couple little things along the way in the discussion that made me question what's really happening. So one of them is they announced they're going to do first class seating also. So the business class seat that they're going to offer has no beds. It's not lie flat. Mm. And the theory is you're only in there 3 to 4 hours. You're going to sit up, right? You're going to work. And then you land when you do it, you know, right? So you don't need a bed, right? I mean, it'll be a short nap for a 4 hour flight to London or 3 hour flight to London. So you don't need to fully recline, which makes sense to me. Sort of like, do you really take advantage of the flatbeds when you get on a United 752 from Newark to Orlando, I guess? Maybe. So I get that, but, you know, he also started talking up, but we could also do 6 to 8 hour flights from San Francisco to Sydney or San Francisco to Tokyo. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, well, that's interesting. And there you would want a bed, right? You'd leave Sydney at night, sleep, you'd land in the morning, or in the afternoon, and you'd be able to go straight to work or vice versa.
Yeah.
So you'd want a bed. But then they put out more details, and they said the range of the first gen is only going to be 4,500 nautical miles.
So you can only do East Coast to Europe, really.
Well, nautical miles, so it's a little further than that. But yes, right, you can do Europe to the Middle East, but not Europe to Asia. You can do Europe to most of the East Coast. Chicago would work too, I think. But you can't do San Francisco, Tokyo, because that's right at 4,400 nautical miles, and you need to account for winds and yada, 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 and there's no way.
Yeah.
All right, that's, I mean, I don't think that would work. I think it's right at the edge, and I wouldn't, based on winds and other things, I probably wouldn't use that as my key marketing demographic based on the specs they're publishing. And it, but like they wrote it as range 9,000 miles and then parentheses 4,500 miles non-refueled. I'm like, well, that just means it's, you go twice as far if you stop. And also you really don't go twice as far because you have to stop somewhere well before you run out of fuel. So anyway, so I'm skeptical on that front. And then the other part is, you know, their claim is it's a $200,000 airplane. Excuse me, $200 million airplane. Got $200,000 to buy one. I find a way. $200 million airplane. So it's expensive relative to commercial aircraft.
Yeah.
He was explicit in saying we aren't doing the whole, like, customary discounts, blah, 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 off a list price. They're selling them for $200 million. And the goal is to – and it's 55 seats. So the theory is that it's smaller than Concorde was in capacity. Concorde had 100 seats on board. It's one in one instead of two and two across, so it's a little more luxurious in space. It's going to have big windows. It's going to beat Concorde in every way. It's going to fly a little faster. And so you only need to just sort of carve off your business class cabin, and you're good to go.
Mm.
Right? But that he's talking about wanting to put it based on every route longer than 1,000 miles, which I don't think there's enough people paying at a premium to do that.
Yeah.
And maybe it's eventually you can do that with coach seating after, you know, you scale up to Gen 3 and it's bigger and has space for that sort of thing. But, you know, he's showing like a map of, you know, potential routes, and it had Tahiti, Easter Island, Santiago on it. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that's great, sexy lines, and I'd love to fly. I mean, you know, it's right, that was a very thin line compared to the bold one of New York, London.
Yeah.
But, or Perth to Sydney, but even Perth, Sydney. I mean, there. I could see people who want it, right? That's a transcon, basically more or less as far as in the United States. It's a long flight. And so I can understand people want to be able to do, you know, a day trip out and back across the country, do their meetings and come back. But is it, you know, a couple hundred a day who are willing to pay $5,000 return for the luxury of doing that? And that's, yeah, that's the part that just, I really want it to work. I would love to fly supersonic. I'd love to fly, you know, at 60,000 feet. I'd love to be on it. And I want it. I want to see it succeed, but I can't help but be skeptical. Just the financials of it just don't seem to line up for me, except in these very few select markets where Concorde was also successful.
Yep. Yep. I get so. You. I'm fascinated by it. I too would love it, but
the more I think about it, I actually believe that London to the West Indies, the British West Indies, sort of some of that, or France to that part of the world, there's a luxury travel market. Barbados, surprisingly enough. I had never realized how luxury travel Barbados was. But I could see Barbados being a market like London, Barbados, or France. I think it's London. I think it's most of the British tourists. I feel like that's a market that could almost support it.
Mm-hmm.
It had Concorde services back in the day, right? So it probably should be able to, especially if you get the cost down. But right, the other problem is if you have connecting feed flights and all these other things, like there's a lot of different ways that you start diminishing the value proposition of like, well, if I then have to connect, it takes, you know, 8 hours instead of 12. Is that enough of a time saving? Versus, right, 8 hours connecting. I think I looked at London, Bangkok was like a 12-hour flight if you take the nonstop, or probably 8-hour total travel time via Dubai.
Mm-hmm.
You had to connect. And just like, is saving that time enough to justify the premium cost?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, that's a tough call because you have 4 hours, is it really? How much, if you're losing 4 or 5 hours, even 8 hours,
yeah.
What's the premium there?
Right. And for some people who are going to pay it are going to pay it. But are there enough of them? And are there airlines willing to separate those people out and potentially lose that yield on their regular operations? Because, right, like those premium passengers are also sort of paying for the regular operations to fly.
Yeah.
So if you have to buy a super expensive plane and move them off, and I mean, are you going to replace those premium seats with coach and like try to just get more total passengers on board to make up for it? I don't know. There's a lot of weird stuff about the economics of it that make me wonder.
Yeah. Yep. I agree.
So that's all I got from the Paris Air Show. Now we're done. We're stopping at McGee. There was actually, there's other cool stuff. I mean, Lockheed Martin now has their C-130 with the like cargo plane.
Yep.
They have a commercial variant now.
Really?
Yeah, they took like all the classified shit out. And it's got a new winch system that's in the floor instead of on a block in the back, and you know, all these things. And it's like the rails on the ground can like flip over to put wheels up or flip down to make it skids, and like just like easy to adjust. I could do it. I figured it out after a couple seconds of poking around. Like, just, you know, all the lockdowns are automated now instead of manual, and they can all happen at once. There's some really neat things. But it it can fly everywhere a C-130 can. So like, it's the big prop, loud, crazy, silly, but they got it. It did its first flight 3 weeks ago and then came over to Paris.
Wow.
Huh. So, yeah. So I don't know. Like, I don't know what the market they're competing with is there. I don't think it's going to displace the big Antonovs, but for like the super heavy oil stuff, but maybe in some, you know, shorter operations it could.
Yeah. Interesting. Let's talk about Alaska Air. Alaska Airline.
Airlines. Don't you live in a hub?
I do.
You can't even get the name of your airline.
I know what it is. It's Alaska Airlines. There you go. Okay.
Okay. There's people who get very, very fussy about that.
Yeah. So on Monday, they said they're going to charter a flight over the Pacific Ocean for the August 21st total eclipse, which is going to come right over the Portland area. It's not going to be directly over us, but southeast of us.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, they did this when there was the eclipse, was it last year or the year before?
Mm-hmm.
One of their Anchorage to Hawaii flights, I think, sort of flew a little out of, they added a little extra fuel and flew a little further than they needed to be able to give the people on board a view of it.
Yep.
So they've clearly shown that they're willing to cater to the crowd. And this one is, they're going to run, it's a charter flight that's being run for astronomy enthusiasts and whatnot. You can't buy tickets, right? It's
They're reaching out.
So, but apparently Alaska is going to open up a contest for a couple seats on board.
Yep.
They've got an agreement with the group to do that. So more to come when it comes. I think they're going to open the contest late July for the flight that's obviously in late August. But it was just, I think it's a neat idea. I think, and they're getting decent publicity out of it because we're talking about it. But
yeah, and they're going to limit the seating on the plane. It's a 737 to 50 people, so you'll basically have a two people in a row.
So could you imagine being the jackass that got stuck in the aisle seat for that one? Excuse me, can I lean out the window too? Can we share cuddle class?
Oh right? Yeah,
middle seat. We can snuggle up, look out the window together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, obviously, right, you would suck to be the guy in the aisle seat, so it helps that they are limiting it. That makes sense.
Yep. And one last thing before we close off the show. We were talking about the travel ban, and there's been some developments in the last couple of
days. Yeah. So earlier this week, the Supreme Court indicated that it would hear the case regarding the travel ban, and this is the prohibition of nationals from six or seven countries from entering the United States.
Yep.
And the latest version of that is that they are now partially allowing it. And it's really, really weird in many ways to me. Just that, you know, the willing to do partial is weird. But basically, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, who have no, quote, bona fide link, unquote, to America, should not plan on traveling for the next 3 months. And it's basically saying that if you are invited to speak, or if you have a job, if you're a student and are accepted into a university, you're a legit visitor and you can still travel. No one else can. And one of the reasons that the lawsuits were upheld initially by the appeal, the sort of Ninth Circuit and some of the other courts, was these are people that have a legit relationship, and leaving them out or leaving them in uncertain scenarios is shitty. And it's, you know, arguably violates due process because you've already told them they can come and you've approved them, and now you're revoking it without any, you know, reasoning. Yeah. And so they're basically saying, oh, well, those are okay. But everybody else does not, you know, have necessarily a relationship and does not have the constitutional protections to arrive. And it's an interesting position. I think obviously they're going to hear it in October. So for the next few months, things are going to be strange, and then they'll hear it and they'll issue a ruling, and things will continue to be strange one way or another. But it's things are moving. So
and people need to be aware of it if you know
yeah.
you have family or friends coming from those countries.
Yeah. Or if you're one of our listeners in those countries.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That'd be awesome. I want to throw one more thing in before we finish because okay. I like to ramble. really? Me? No.
We mentioned that on the last show. I'm not sure if you heard it while you were editing.
I don't listen to the shows when I edit. Are you kidding? I haven't had time to listen to the last one yet, I'm afraid. The United and Air Canada had applied for sort of joint venture trans-border rights a while back, and a few years ago now, and that actually got approved, but didn't like the restrictions the approval came with. It was basically considered it not sufficiently flexible for their joint venture. Mm-hmm. Had to give up, you know, slots or routes or couldn't cooperate on certain routes and things like that. They didn't like it. So they ended up not implementing it as approved. There's news out this week saying that they're, quote, eager to revive this revenue sharing agreement on cross-border routes. Canada has passed a bill. The Canadian Parliament has introduced a bill allowing for making it easier to have these things approved more liberally. And presumably the current U.S. administration would also be more liberal and such. So if it passes in Canada, we'll have to see. Again, 2012 was when they last applied. Jeez, time flies, man. Yeah, and they were declined because it would create a monopoly on 10 different routes. And so they were it's not that they were declined. It's that those 10 were going to be carved out, and that got bad. So anyway, something to look at, something to consider. It might be coming along.
Do you think then they'll revenue share on transiting flights as well? So say, you know, U.S. to Asia, Canada is relatively cheap.
That to work, they would also need the Asian, like the destination country would have to allow it.
Gotcha.
Right. That's why like the current U.S. ANA or the United ANA relationship doesn't include China, India, or Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in their joint venture, because those countries said no.
Gotcha.
So that's part of it. Yeah. But I had another story I wanted to mention now. Like, while I was talking during the last one, something else came up in my brain that was really cool. And I completely blanked on it while I was talking.
Oh, man.
Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Yeah, seriously. I really had something good. Uh-huh. Bummer.
Bummer.
Oh, yeah, we might. The laptop ban thing is still not going to happen, but we're going to change all the rules for flights into the United States.
How so?
I don't know. There's the person, our secretary of something, Secretary of Transportation,
mm-hmm.
Homeland Security, Secretary Kelly, is presenting it literally while we're recording right now.
Oh, well, so we need to be watching on Twitter. Or
I imagine there's like, you know, a real feed we could watch. Anywho. That might change too, but it looks like a way to not have the electronics ban, but it means major changes to some security, like better screening or this, that, or you have to go electronics ban. So we'll see. Interesting.
For all flights into the U.S. coming soon.
Yeah. You know, for asterisk for certain definitions of all.
Wow.
As is always the case. Oh, I remember what it is now. This is amazing. Great chat, Stephen. Really appreciate it. There has been a bill introduced in the House of Representatives to change airfare pricing rules to allow the airlines to stop advertising all-in prices again. So remember a couple years back, the Department of Transportation basically used its false advertising enforcement rules to say airlines cannot put, you know, starting at $199 asterisk plus $86 in taxes and fees.
Yeah.
Yeah, to advertise that is $285. And the airlines hate it because it makes things look more expensive, but it's the actual price. The airlines want to be able to advertise just the base number and have the all-in price after tax show up later in the process. And a bill has been introduced that's going to allow them to do that, basically telling the DOT to shut the hell up.
Who introduced it?
People in the House of Representatives. I think it was actually bipartisan, believe it or not.
Some folks getting lobbied hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'll find the link. I remember it while we were talking, but I haven't found the link again. And I've been on the road for like ever. And so I haven't been reading enough of the details of these things, but that was one where I've certainly read the headline. and I know it's happening. Ed from Pizza in Motion has also been on a few times. I know he wrote about it, so I'll throw a link to his story airlines would no longer have to include taxes when initially advertising their fares under House legislation a committee will vote on Tuesday.
Yeah, that blows.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That really
bullshit.
Blows.
But Airlines for America is massively supporting it. And
well, of course they are.
They support their customers, which are the airlines, not us as people. So remember that when you see their crap online. They're often not looking out for us.
Yep. Yep. Agreed. Oh, well, I think that's a show. What do you think?
I think it has to be. Yeah. We've talked for a long, long time.
It's been 50 minutes.
Indeed. Well, but half of that was us trying to figure out what the hell we were actually going to talk about, so you know.
Oh, man. Well, our listeners can find us on Twitter at DotsLines, moredotsmorelines.com. We also have a Patreon account if you want to support the show. Yeah, leave us a comment. Leave us a review on iTunes. Love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and happy travels. Bye-bye.
Take care.